Blog Talk Radio.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 1 hour a week. Tune in to Unlock Your Wealth Radio with Heather Wagner. She'll show you how without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagner.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to the broadcast. We're in our last week of Financial Literacy Month. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not quite sure. Anyway, welcome to the show for Saturday, April 25th. We are broadcasting live from the Log Mahal in Payson, Arizona. And like this Saturday, every Saturday at 10 a.m. Pacific, we broadcast the Unlock Your Wealth radio program and talk about our family of crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help every man, woman, and child alike manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of financial independence. Today's broadcast is going to be so exciting. I'm so thrilled about the guests that I have for you this week, as well as the e-zine has hit a new high with our subscriber number. So I was really blown away by the number of downloads that we just saw this week for the past show. So for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, if you are unable to join us at 10 a.m. on Saturdays, you, at your convenience, can download the broadcast and listen at your leisure. That's right, because at our show page, if you click through the unlockyourwealth.com website, our radio player is right on there, and you can listen to any archived episode and listen to your heart's content. And I'm just so tickled because the e-zine has new subscriber signups every week, and the program is just growing. So I'm so excited that all of you value the content that we bring you every week. I'm tickled about that. Would you like to become a subscriber to the e-zine? It is so simple. All you have to do is send us an email at e-zine, E-Z-I-N-E, at unlockyourwealth.com, or if you go visit the website itself, you can get to it simply by signing up on our website at www.unlockyourwealth.com, and all you have to do is click on the radio show page, and voila, you too can be a subscriber to the e-zine. What are the benefits of subscribing to the e-zine? Very simply, you get all of the information about upcoming guests that we have, plus you also have the advantage of the trivia question being broadcast through that e-zine, so you have an opportunity to read that question before everybody else so you can prepare to win, yes, because we always have fabulous prizes. So, I just wanted to bring that to your attention because we base our questions off of the previous week's broadcast. So you can take, and if you haven't listened by getting the e-zine, you can listen to the archive broadcast to figure out what the answer is for the trivia question, and then call in to win. We always have fabulous prizes. For example, last week we had Mac Newton on, and he's a motivational speaker. He shared some of his stories about taking action and how when he was at his worst, how he was able to flip that switch and create the life he so dreamed of. So I was pretty impressed by that. So we gave out autographed books signed by him, and I actually have two more books left. He was so gracious, he was able to sign a few. So this week, for our trivia question this week, you will also be able to win his books. You will actually have your choice. You can choose to win his books, or I also have for you coaching From the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation, yes, you can have 13 weeks of financial coaching for nada. Well, the charge is that you have to win the trivia question for the week. So this week we have some incredible guests on tap. Our Minutes on Your Money this week is going to be kind of fun because I picked a few articles that had to do with five. We have different types of tips for you in the number of five. So five will be our number today. For our Investor's Edge segment, we will have the fabulous and ever-popular lender, Lonnie Gibson with Core Mortgage. And we are going to talk about new lending requirements and bennies that Fannie Mae has given us for investors and how you can bridge that financing gap to take and capitalize on what's going on in today's real estate markets with all of the foreclosures out there. So one of the great things that Lonnie brings to the table, and I have to share with you about him before he comes on here shortly, is that Lonnie and I worked together, well, we started working together 10 years ago, and he really helped influence me to really help people and showed me how to bridge the gap of understanding when it comes to mortgage finance. And what was the catalyst, I guess, if you will, for the Keys to Riches and then the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation and all the tools that we bring to you here on the radio show was inspired by a little home buyers club we started in 2000 that helped our mortgage clients who couldn't qualify for today's financing. They were able to help them tweak their credit, reduce their debt, or help them save and create the right financial profile so they would qualify. And Solani helped me do that, and so I'm very pleased and honored that he would be a guest of ours this week. Nuts and Bolts is going to be about this week's key, which is dreams with deadlines. We're going to talk about goal setting and how we create our short and long-term goals. And our piggyback guest to that is none other than the godfather of NASCAR diecast, Fred Wagenhals. And in addition to being my favorite man, because he is my husband, I have the utmost respect and admiration for what he has accomplished personally and professionally. And I couldn't think of a better guest for us to have this week. So we're going to talk to him in the second hour about how he goal sets and the tips and tricks that he has used to stay in the game and not lose sight of his goals. We also have a new sponsor this week, Laborless Magazine, which is an incredible fictional lifestyle magazine. Not only is it available in Arizona, but you too can be a subscriber to the paper magazine, or you can also view the magazine online at www.sociallyacceptable.org. So in addition to our regularly scheduled segments, we also have the fabulous Karen Gurm live here at the Log Mahal in Payson, Arizona, to do our News by the Numbers segment. And, of course, our key this week, Dreams with Deadlines, we will go through our key statement, affirmations, and action items for us to do this upcoming week. So let us get underway with our fabulous broadcast, and we are going to talk about some minutes on your money. So I pulled these articles with the fives, and one of my favorite writers is Jim Juback, and he has five rules for post-recovery investment. Now, he talks about the Great Recession, which people are referring to as what we are in, and he compares and contrasts this in his article on MSN Money this week with the Great Depression. And the Great Depression was long enough and painful enough to form the habits for a full generation. Let me just tell you, my mother is one of those people, and still today, with the advent of grocery stores and convenience shopping 24 hours, my mother, if anything ever happens, you should all make your way to her house because she has a bomb shelter's worth of food. I remember growing up, she always had that deep freezer that she could store a couple dead bodies in full of meat in the event of a catastrophe, as well as a plethora of canned goods. And she would have a heart attack anytime those little trick-or-treaters would come around for donations for canned goods, and my brother and I would run to give them the crappy stuff we didn't want to eat. And let me just tell you, she would be right there at the door. No, you put that back. That's for emergencies. So let me just tell you, I am witness to some of those habits. But the members of that generation, in addition to becoming prodigious accumulators of delayed food gratification, they were also dedicated savers. They completely avoided debt, and they paid cash for everything, keeping their eyes focused always on the long run. So how perfect is that for this week's key being dreams with deadlines? So this current downturn that everybody's been referring to as the Great Recession has already been the longest recession since World War II. But in the new world that's emerging after this recovery, I think finally people will save, spend, and look at debt and think about debt a little different, or at least as one could hope. So at first glance, our current Great Recession doesn't look like it could hold a candle to the Great Depression on duration. But, you know, this current downturn officially began in December of 07. So that puts us in month 17 as of this month here in April. So he's got this really cool color-coded chart showing durations for recessions that we have had before, and we just eked out the last one, or the longest one, that we had in the 50s. So who's to say that this one is worse? But because our economy is so much broader, you know, I think if we went with a per capita reflection, and I don't see that here in this article, but if we went per capita, I think the numbers would be on target. But because our economy is so much broader, we have so many people and players in the marketplace now, that I think that is what is making this so great, as people seem to call it. The Great Depression, however, seemed longer because the recovery was very anemic and punctuated by huge setbacks. Okay, we resumed growth in 33, but actual gross domestic product didn't recover until 1940, which were at the levels pre-Great Depression of $97 billion. So because the recovery was so slow and the economy was growing but not at a significant rate, people in the United States seemed like the Depression felt like it stretched on and on, even though it really wasn't as long as people seem to think it is. They're projecting that our current economic situation will be back on its feet by 2015, but we probably won't be sprinting to that point. So let's talk now about the five things that he recommends that we can do. Because it is not simply business as usual, he suggests that these five new world rules that we consider before moving forward. One is to shy away from companies where their business plan going forward is just simply a hope that things get back to normal. At minimum, he says, a company should recognize that the world has changed. And a good example of that is that Starbucks is a classic pre-crisis consumer business. They are currently looking for a new formula. Additionally, the next thing he recommends is the new value definition will be easier for some, and that's to recognize that some companies have less distance to travel in meeting a new value proposition. McDonald's needs to tweak its menus. Starbucks may need a top-to-bottom reinvention. Coach, the handbag, needs to balance its full price and outlet sales. And Tiffany's, that favorite baby blue box we all love, needs to experiment to find its niche in a new economy. He also says value doesn't simply mean low price. And he says he doesn't know, and neither does a company, whether or not a new emphasis on organic and health food is reasonable and prices will succeed in revitalizing sales. Whole Foods Markets is one of them, But the position makes sense in a post-recovery economy. But again, we don't know because the pricing just isn't quite there yet. Cost cutting will be essential for you to look at when deciding whether or not to invest in a new company. A company such as Intel that has built its long-term strategy on constantly cutting costs by constantly improving production and technology is well positioned for the new world. Low-cost producers like Nokia also have an edge in this environment if they can combine low cost with perceived consumer sales. Perceived consumer value at the cash register sale point. Look for clear business strategies is his final recommendation, and that would be to look for companies that have clearly articulated flexible strategies for coping with the value shift. Procter & Gamble, for example, has directed its advertising in developed economies to try to convince consumers that its brands deliver more value, that they work better, contain less water, etc., even though their prices are higher. So in developing economies, the company is working to cut prices to win market share and create a better brand recognition. We will pepper the rest of the broadcast with more tips and minutes on your money, but we have our guest for Investor's Edge on deck for us. So like I was telling you before, Lonnie Gibson is at Core Mortgage, and he is my preferred lender for all of my real estate agents at the HQ Real Estate and Investment Company, where we work to create our niche by working with investors and seasoning current renters and homeowners and helping them to be positioned for long-term financial investment through real estate by first starting out as a homeowner and then working to become a real estate investor. Now, I'm really thrilled to have Lonnie on the show because when I first came up with the Keys to Riches, we worked together at the same mortgage company. And as I was developing the Keys to Riches, they evolved from my little home buyers club that I created for our clients that weren't able to buy today. These were people that maybe needed to tweak their credit, reduce some debt, get more time on the job, or create some sort of savings to be able to become homeowners. So they just needed a little bit of help, and instead of taking a subprime mortgage, it made more sense to maximize their affordability by spending some time in this weekend home buyers club that we set up, and we just taught them the skills that they needed to know on basic mortgage underwriting guidelines. And I'm really grateful because Lonnie helped me to bring my information and the educational process to these people, and he was very supportive of that. And this radio broadcast is a direct result of the value that he brought to my life as well as the lives of all the people we worked with. So I'm going to introduce Lonnie and welcome him to the broadcast right now. Lonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. How are you?
I am so thrilled that you are here today.
Well, so am I. Thank you.
Yeah, you're my favorite lender, and mostly because of our history together, I have always loved and adored you for the value that you brought to my life and the lives of our clients. But for today, you bring huge value to my new real estate agents, as well as my seasoned agents who you help bring through the education process of lending. And I like that you don't pull any punches. You're not the lender that takes and tells people, yeah, you're good to go. Let me write you a conditional loan approval. And then, you know, 2 weeks before close of escrow, you're like, oh, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. And what I also like is not only do you tell people up front, hey, this loan isn't going to fly, but you tell them what they need to work on so it's not a mystery, so they can get to the home ownership level or the real estate investment level. And so that's why I'm so grateful for you to be a part of what I'm doing professionally with the real estate company. So I just kind of wanted to thank you officially on air for that.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you allowing me to work with you and your customers very much. As you
well,
know,
they
things
really
have changed a great deal since we used to do mortgages.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I wanted to talk with. You know, it's kind of interesting. I look at what has gone on, and I think that that it's not so much that lending has changed, and you can say yes or no, but in my observation from the real estate side, it looks like it hasn't really changed that much, that we just came back to our core values and traditional underwriting standards. Am I on target with that?
You're absolutely correct. I think we're getting back to a market that we used to be. In the past, we've had customers, their intention to buy a home was not for to enjoyment, for a place to live in, but it's somewhere to just flip it and make a nice profit on it. And that's not what these whole programs were set out to be. We're now back to we're buying a home to enjoy. If we're buying it to invest, we're legitimately going to try to invest in this real estate and rent the property out, not just simply put it on the market immediately to make a profit. So I think that we're easily back to where we first started years ago.
Well, and I think that at least for the professionals that work within the industry, that's a good thing because it flushed out all of the sleazy realtors and loan officers that were just in it to get rich quick. And it didn't matter what it took to make a transaction fly, they would be delighted to step over those ethical lines and create fraud in whatever it needed to occur in order to get people to close transactions. And we're seeing the ramifications of that today with the high rate of foreclosures because, you know, some of that has to do with the unscrupulous professionals. And fortunately, because they never had saleable skills in the industry has kind of weeded themselves out with what's gone on in the marketplace. But I'm sure, have you seen your activity in quality loan applications go up lately?
The activity is tremendous right now, not only just the activity of people out there looking for homes now, but absolutely, people now realize that, you know what, it's going to take a little bit of a down payment to actually buy a home, and they need to be conscious of my credit and how I've paid things on time. So absolutely, that we've seen that as a direct result of what's happened the past few years.
Well, what I wanted to speak to today, because our Investor's Edge segment is specifically about the people who have either made it through the Keys to Riches program in its entirety, and they are positioned for real estate investment, or our seasoned investors that participate in our master's program, and I'm trying to help bring them new information. Now, in January, I think it was January or February, Fannie Mae changed the requirements now for investors to make it a little bit easier for them to capitalize on today's market. Can you talk about some of those guidelines for investors that have changed?
Well, the big change now is you're able to actually finance a great deal more properties than what you used to be. In the past, you were quite limited with most of the investors would not allow you to have more than finance properties. They've now increased that dramatically where you can own more properties. They've also done another program which allows the investors now to purchase the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae foreclosed homes at a little lower down payment and no mortgage insurance to take advantage of deals that are out there as well. So for the person which is an experienced or has a good track history as an investor, there are a lot of good deals out there for them available.
Can we talk specifically about some of the underwriting criteria for real estate investment when they want to go with these good quality Fannie Freddie loans? What kind of ratios for housing and total debt do our investors need to have?
As a ratio sense, you need to have what they call no more than 45% of your total debt-to-income ratio, which means all your debts, including the new mortgage on the new property, cannot exceed more than 45% of your gross or your actual taxable income. They've also got credit guidelines where you need to have a middle credit score of 720 or above and above. You also need to have what they call 6 months' worth of reserves or 6 months' available in the bank for each property worth of payments as well. They do have a minimum down payment requirement now of 20%. However, if a person can go an additional 5% for a total of 25%, there is a huge benefit in the interest rate as well, too.
Okay, can you go over that down payment amount? The phone cut out a little bit when you were saying that, and it got garbled.
I apologize. The minimum down payment for the investment property right now is 20%. However, if a person puts 25% down, it is a big difference and improvement on the interest rate for that additional 5%.
Oh, wow. So, and that's, you know, especially at today's low foreclosure prices, that's not that much more money.
Not at all.
Now, when I went with one of my investment clients and we went down to an auction and we sat down, you know, you had to bring bank statements and you had to get pre-approved with their lender on site before you could get your bidder number. And so I had all my bank statements for the properties that I was going to pay cash for, and then I wanted to be able to leverage myself on some of them. And so I sat with the lender, and when I sat with him, he told me that my minimum loan amount had to be $30,000. Is that a Fannie Freddie requirement, or was that just that particular lender's requirement?
I'm not sure on that particular situation there, but there is a program out there which was more for the owner-occupied, which was called a Section 32 program, where your closing costs cannot exceed more than 5% of your total sales price. Now, what a lot of folks are doing now is that's actually for your owner-occupied, but some of the banks now are implying or requiring that same sort of model for the investment properties as well, because they don't want to appear that they're getting involved in this subprime type lending or taking advantage of people. So it's likely what they've said there is listen, we know the closing costs are going to be such high as far as a percent. We don't want to appear to be a predatory lender, and that's why we're doing that.
Okay, and I can see how easily those costs will escalate. If you can pick up a property for $15,000, but your title work and escrow charges are going to be, you know, because of the way the home is, probably like $700 or $800, you could easily exceed typical ratios for closing costs real simply. You know, plus you still have tax escrows that even though the property is only $15,000, that doesn't mean that the tax valuation isn't still $150,000.
Sure, absolutely. And if you look at that as a percent, it appears that what you're doing is you're taking advantage of the people, but when you calculate and look at it, it's fixed cost, you're really not. And lenders they recognize that, and they don't want to be classified as predatory type lenders, which is kind of what got us in this mess in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Now, what percentage, and I remember back when we were lending in the early part of the decade, and I haven't done those type of loans in quite some time, but I remember when we were working with investors and you were bringing them, you were buying properties that already had tenants in them and you were using those seasoned leases, what percentage of that rent payment can we use toward covering that loan payment? I think I remember it was 75% of the rental amount that you could credit toward the loan payment. Is that still the same, or did that change with the different times that we're in?
That is still accurate. That percent is still the 75%. Now, let's also assume, take that one step farther. If you have an individual that has got experience of being a landlord and they're purchasing a home that does not have a current renter in there, the appraiser will do a rent survey and tell us, hey, this house should rent for approximately this. You're able to apply that 75% of what the appraiser says as well, even though you don't have a tenant in there yet. But this is for our experienced investors.
Okay, so that means that they own one or more rental properties that are financed? Would that be how you define that?
I would say it would be someone that either owns one or more in the last 24 months or has owned in the past and can document that. And the way to document that, you'd show on your tax returns you had a Schedule E.
Okay. Well, that's great to know. So people that may have gotten out of the landlord game when prices became too unrealistic for them to make the properties cash flow, so now they can get back in the game.
Absolutely.
So they're not going to be penalized because they just don't currently hold any investor property, but as long as they can demonstrate that they can still be able to qualify for that rent survey if there's not a current tenant in it. And I want to make it a point that the reason why I'm sharing this with the audience, because some of you are probably sitting there perplexed saying, well, why am I going to get a hit on the rent? Why can't I count that? But the reason why is your mortgage payment is only a portion of your obligation as a landlord. You still have to subsidize a sinking fund for long-term repairs and maintenance on the property as well. So people don't realize that that's a part of the rent too, and you can't count that. Plus, you also have your, hopefully, if you structured your transaction right, your profit margin on that too. So that's why you want to, that's why lenders only count 75% of that payment, because they know that that's not the total cost of your rental property, that's only a portion of it. And I just wanted to share that with everybody to add a point of clarification, because I remember when people were getting into the rental game and were becoming real estate investors, they're like, well, that's not fair. And then once I was able to explain why that happened, then they were like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, you're right, because 100% of my rent isn't going to go, or 100% of my obligation to this property isn't just the mortgage payment. What else do investors need to know about this current market?
Current market. Well, obviously you're going to, in the past, something that we looked at when they actually determined if they were going to buy a property, really typically they were looking at what the appreciation is going to be, and that's what they determined that. And an important factor that came up now, which is not a new factor, it's been around for a great deal of time, is the property going to cash flow? Are you paying enough for it and you're paying little enough for it and your mortgage payment is going to, can you rent enough to cover that mortgage payment and those costs that you were just talking about? So it's important also to not only is it going to appreciate and I can make money in the future, is it probably going to be able to cash flow, or am I going to have to every month put out more money than what I actually bringing into that? And that's something that the banks and the lending institutions are looking at as well. They're leery to finance a property that's not going to cash flow.
Okay. one of the things that I noticed when I was working on a transaction yesterday with one of my agents, and we were going through and we were structuring the transaction, and we went to the tax records, the county tax records, to take a look at who the legal owner was and the mailing address and all of that stuff so we could structure our contract. When we were looking at the tax obligation, we noticed that 2010 preliminary numbers are already out, and how is that going to come into play with what's going on, or at least with what lenders are looking at, because the 2010 tax assessed figures are lower than 2009. What is that saying? Is that sending a red flag to lenders, or what's the current perception of the lenders with regard to value?
Well, that's going to be the million-dollar question there as well. And along with that million-dollar question, this goes not into the not only with the investors, but it also is going along with everyone's. We're wondering, is our tax obligation going to go down because our values are going to be going down? And, of course, the government, you know, the county and the state still have these large budgets. It seems unlikely they're going to lower that tax obligation even though those values have went down. So that's obviously a concern with everyone. But as far as actually looking at those and determining, well, are we concerned where we're going to require larger down payments? charge more for mortgage insurance if needed, those sort of things. Nothing has really come out about that yet, with the exception that we are seeing a lot of folks on the appraisals. They're requiring what they call review appraisals, or they're having a professional review what the professional appraisal has already done to get kind of a second set of eyes on that thing. We're seeing a great deal of that. They've also tightened up as far as what they'll allow for comparables on the appraisals. They're looking for something when they're looking in a neighborhood to see what's sold. They really want to see something that's sold within the last 90 days in that specific neighborhood. So I think it kind of in answer to your question, they're really, really looking at the values to make sure that they've got an accurate value right now, and that if it's going to go down, that it's not going to be as large of a loss as what they would have been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that given the current market, are appraisers taking into account the foreclosures in the individual neighborhoods when they're making their assessment? Like, let's say somebody is willing buyer, willing seller, negotiating for the, in an open market, not a short sale, not a foreclosure, and they agree upon a particular price. Are appraisers using foreclosure comps and dragging down values, or are they able to make those numbers? What are you seeing?
Unfortunately, they are. In the past, they did not use those as much, but they are using them more than what they had in the past. So, yeah, it is affecting them, absolutely.
Now, I would like to broaden our scope for the rest of the audience because we've been talking specifically about investors now, to talk about just general loans for owner-occupied. Somebody wants to buy a home. What are some of the new FHA requirements that have come out? I know that there's been a few changes with FHA, mortgage insurance, down payment and stuff.
Mortgage insurance now, you have lump sum mortgage insurance, which is now 1.75%, which they finance into the loan. Then they charge 0.55% a month until it amortizes down to where you have 22% equity. So the mortgage insurance really, as far as changes, the calculation has changed a little bit, but the being there has always been in the past. And they've played around with that several times in the past as well, too. One thing I am seeing, though, quite a bit of, is the credit qualifications have went up on those than what they have in the past. In the past, it didn't have a specific credit score or minimum credit score that they would allow on these. Now most of the banks that we're working with now are requiring at least a 620 or greater score. The ratios in the past, if the debt-to-income ratios were a little higher than the minimum standards, which is 43% for all your debts total, if they exceeded and when it went through the computer model and it said it was okay, they didn't care. Now they're looking at that a little more carefully, and they're really making sure people are not overbuying.
Okay. What's the minimum down payment for FHA now?
Minimum down payment as of January 1 is now increased from 3% to 3.5%, and your down payment has to come from your own funds. It can be a gift from a relative or someone with a close relationship with you, or it can come from a nonprofit agency. And it cannot come through a third party where we do one of these programs where the seller is gifting to a nonprofit and the nonprofit is gifting to you. Those programs are no longer available.
Is there any bond money or any other government assistance that's out there for home ownership like we used to see?
There is a program which they're putting together, and they've actually already started it through the city of Phoenix, where they get them up to $15,000. That's the only program that I've seen available so far. I know Maricopa, or the city of Phoenix, was allowed $38 million to apply towards that. It does require some home buying counseling. It does have what they call a recapture, which means if you ever sell the home or refinance it, you have to pay it back. The biggest thing right out there right now for first-time home buyers or someone that hasn't owned in the last 3 years is that tax credit that you're available to get up to $8,000.
And that's the one from the Obama administration?
Exactly.
And somebody told me that it's retroactive. How far back can it go?
That's on the bill that I have read. It only goes back to January of this year. There is another one from last year for $7,500, I believe, and don't quote me on it. I believe that goes back to June or July of last year.
And how long is the $8,000 credit available for new or returning home buyers?
That's good through this year.
Oh, so just this year. So it goes away in December. Well, that kind of works well. You know, it gets people to be motivated to get their ducks in a row. Really quick, what would you say are some real quick tips that you have for people that are looking to buy and some really quick things that they can do before they come to see you for a loan?
Number one is they do need to talk with someone before they even get started. Even before they sit down with their agent or right immediately after they talk with their agent, because there's a lot of things there that may allow you to qualify maybe a little higher than things that you didn't think about or programs that are available you would not be familiar with. But things to come with you, come to the application with, they're going to look at your last 2 years' tax returns, W-2s. They're going to want to see your recent pay stub, recent bank statements. And it's a good idea to kind of have a pretty good idea where you are in your credit scores as well prior to that, because that's going to affect the interest rates you pay as well.
Is there any more automated underwriting, or is it all manual underwrite now?
It is automated, but it's double and triple checked by an individual. All the findings and everything are triple checked. And there's different interpretations of those as well, and that's going to vary bank by bank as well. One thing I would caution everyone now, it was very popular in the past to do the shopping for the mortgages on the Internet. What I'm finding with most folks that I'm dealing with that have been shopping on the Internet, although they may appear right up front that they're getting a really good interest rate and a really good deal, they're paying a deposit to get started, when it comes time to closing, a good portion of them are not getting the deal that they think they're getting. So I would encourage you when you're doing that shopping that you get what they call a cost estimate in writing. And do that shopping with a couple of places, but not just only Internet, but someone you actually can see and talk with face-to-face as well.
Great. So if folks want to get a hold of you at Core Mortgage, if they're in Arizona, they can call you at 480-993-3000. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us. I know you have family in from out of town, so I'm really honored that you still took the time to be a part of our broadcast today, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend. I know our listeners are really excited about being able to learn about mortgage finance specifically because everybody's heard the horror stories and everybody says that nobody's giving away money. And I said, well, no, you're wrong, because Lonnie is and he has plenty of it. So I just wanted to thank you again for being a part of the show. And
okay, well,
folks can call you. Oh, you're welcome, Lonnie. You're my favorite lender by far.
Oh, so. You're my favorite radio person.
Yay! Well, again, folks, for those of you who are interested in finding out more about home financing, if you're thinking about buying or investing, make sure that you give Lonnie a call. Again, his company is Core Mortgage, and he is available at 480-993-3000. 480-993-3000. We will have more in store after this.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagonhals on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am your host, Heather Wagenhals. We just visited with Lonnie Gibson for our Investor's Edge segment, and he brought out some great information and things that have changed since the last time I looked into the mortgage qualifying at the beginning of the year. So what we're going to do for you folks, if you don't want to sit and listen to the broadcast 20 times and download it on your iPod, although I hope you do that because I want it to be your favorite show, I will take and create a page on the Unlock Your Wealth website with some of the tips and tricks that Lonnie Gibson has given us to create the ideal borrowing scenario for you. Like he said, the tax credit runs out at the end of the year, so if you're thinking about buying or returning to home ownership, if you haven't owned a property in the last 3 years, it looks like between now and December is the last time you can capitalize on that. So it's super great to try to get a hold of your credit profile and take a look at where your credit is at and see where your finances are and meet with Lonnie or your preferred lender and see what it's going to take to get you into the opportunity of home ownership, because prices are not going to be any lower. Back to minutes on your money and getting back to our next set of five, Liz Pulliam Weston, you know, she's one of my fave writers, and she's pretty prolific on the internet, most popular. You can find her and download her regularly on the MSN Money in the personal finance section. And today she has five car rental traps for you to steer clear of. It seems that renting a car is getting trickier by the day. Finding a good deal has gotten more difficult. Since automakers have cut back on discounted sales to big fleet buyers, rental companies are now raising their rates. Local governments have also piled on new taxes for rentals, trying to stimulate their economies locally. In addition, many franchises are charging fees for things that used to be free. Now, meanwhile, getting an upgrade to a bigger car is something that's more likely that busy rental counters run out of the cheaper vehicles could result in financial disaster now, since some common rental vehicles are often excluded from the insurance coverage. And let me just tell you from personal experience that that insurance is super invaluable. I went to go rent a car, and I allowed my husband to drive it, and he had no idea what he did to the back quarter panel of the car because he was busy yapping on the phone, and I kept telling him that he was going to hit this mailbox, and he completely uprooted the mailbox from our friend's yard with the back quarter panel of this rental car, and I had to stand there and go, yeah. And I typically decline most types of insurances and warranties, like when you buy computers and electronics. I'm like, I'll just throw it away and get another one, because I usually think that's a waste of money. But for some reason, I had this clairvoyant moment, must be the gypsy history in my Romanian past from my great-grandmother, that said, I think you should get this insurance, because I had to stand there and say, I had an accident, and file the claim. And my lovely husband even tried to abandon me at the rental counter because he was laughing so hard because of what happened. So from personal experience, that's something that's kind of valuable, and your personal car insurance may or may not cover it, so that could be an out-of-pocket expense. So here are some traps to avoid when you're navigating car rentals. Number one, limiting your search. Unfortunately, there's no single website that always has the best deals, and there's no single car category that's always cheapest. So to find a good rate, you're going to need to scour the web. One thing you might want to consider is to start with a travel site, because they usually have access to several different companies. So, for example, Expedia, Travelocity, or Orbitz. And then you can also check out prices on Hotwire.com or Priceline. And then if you're still not satisfied with the numbers you're getting, you can explore some of the rental company sites looking for specific specials. You can also subscribe to some of their electronic news media, and I know we don't need more garbage in our inbox, but however, they may offer great specials and incentives just to the subscribers. So the earlier you start looking, the better. Booking in advance will hedge against future prices because you can lock it in at that time. Additionally, you're not locked in if the rates should drop, so that's a value. But if you're looking to travel at high travel times, at peak holiday travel, or convention travel where you know 100,000 people are going to be descending into a particular city, the sooner the better. And don't always assume that smaller is less expensive. Sometimes, because of demand, those little subcompact cars could cost you more than that luxury rental. So make sure that you shop. Number two, not factoring in taxes. State and local governments have discovered the perfect patsies. I love how this is construed, is rental car drivers. In many areas, various government-mandated charges can make up to 20 to 40% of your total bill. And so that's something that you need to consider. Additionally, airports that used to not charge fees in the past now lard them on. At LAX, for example, car renters pay a, quote, airport concession and an additional customer facility fee in addition to another California Tourism Commission assessment. So I love how Liz says this. In other words, tourists to La La Land get to pay the state to lure other tourists to La La Land. So now you are subsidizing the state's advertising budget to attract other tourists. Some of these fees relate to the cost of building and maintaining airports, but other municipal projects that you will never, ever get to reap the benefits of. For example, in Boston, rental car drivers pay a fee to help for the city's convention center. What if you're not going there? LAX fees include an airport facility that hasn't even been built yet, and that's according to rental car industry expert Neil Abrams. You want to look for full disclosure and consider renting off-site from an airport location. You still have to pay taxes and some fees, but then you're not subjected to all of those airport costs that you may have to. Also, you may want to weigh whether or not you even really need a rental car, because sometimes public transportation can be more economical. You know, I know that I was blown away when we traveled abroad, and in Hong Kong, it's like $3 U.S. to rent a car or to rent a taxi to have them take you from one side of the harbor to the other. So you might be better off not renting a car, because then you have to figure out where to park it and parking fees. So it might just be more financially feasible and lighter on your wallet to just take taxis and public transportation. The third trap to watch out for is letting the add-on fees empty your wallet. So be careful about late fees, fuel charges, or younger drivers. Also, one-way charges. If you're not staying in a city but driving between cities and it's not a round trip, you can get banged on that. And mileage charges. You know, if your friend barfs in the back seat from heavy partying the night before, it might behoove you to go vacuum out the contents at a local self-serve automat to clean that up, because you could be subjected up to $50 worth of extra cleaning charges. Don't leave that bag of McDonald's in the back seat. It's kind of ridiculous. I got whacked on that when they charged me $25 because I was too lazy to reach over the seat and grab the trash that I had already bagged up. All they had to do is take the whole bag and put it in the trash, and I got whacked $25 when that bill finally came in, and I had a heart attack about that. Also, additional equipment rentals can really start to rack that up too, like navigation systems, ski racks, child car seats, or satellite radio. They can bang you again on that bill for that kind of stuff. So watch out for those little hidden charges for additional items. Number four, the fourth trap she says to watch out for is paying for damage that's not your fault, like acts of nature, hailstorms, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, and other disasters. Even if you couldn't predict it, you should not be on the hook for it. So take a look for that. Less catastrophic damage, though, can get you into trouble, little dings or scrapes. So kind of survey the vehicle. And with the advent of cell phones being so fabulous with little digicams, go ahead and take pictures of it just as an added insurance policy before you go and hop on that plane. That extra 30 seconds it would take to walk around and get some good still shots, if you're worried about something like that, that's great insurance for you if they try to ban you for that. And last but not least, don't get lost in the insurance maze. But like I said before, the usual advice you hear is skip the coverage. It's not enough, but you know, in general, the coverage you got on your personal vehicle should roll over, but it may not cover everything. So if you have altered your current coverage, your personal insurance coverage, to save money, it could be an issue, and that few extra bucks, that one just might be worth it. I'm telling you, I signed this piece of paper, I walked away from the car, and that was the last I ever heard of that particular vehicle insurance. And it didn't affect me. It didn't affect, you know, my driving history. I didn't get a surcharge on my driving record or anything like that. So those are the five tips to help save you some cash at the rental car counter. We have more for you coming up. But right now, we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for more Unlock Your Wealth Radio right after this.
The best things in life are free. Can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhals, bringing you this incredible show on our last week in the April Financial Literacy Month. Now, I do have to share a personal note, though. I am very disappointed that my guest host, Connor Wagenhals, didn't join the broadcast this morning and introduce me. And I am sad to say that I got beaten out by the Godfather 2 video game, so I don't know what that says for America, but I just thought I would share that with you because I thought it was kind of funny. So anyhow, we have for this hour one of my very special guests and my darling husband, who's going to talk with us during Nuts and Bolts about today's key, which is Dreams with Deadlines. Additionally, I forgot to give you the trivia question at the beginning of the show. This week's trivia question is from last week's broadcast, where our featured guest on Investor's Edge was Dan Carlinzoli, and he talked about buying HUD homes. And he mentioned several things to look out for, but this trivia question to win your choice of books from Mac Newton or 13 weeks of financial coaching from the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation. The question is, what are two of the biggest mistakes people make or forget to check out when buying HUD homes? So if you are interested to call in and try your hat at winning the trivia question this week, our show call-in number is area code 718-508-9002. That's 718-508-9002. I'm very excited right now. I'd like to bring to you our regularly scheduled segment, News by the Numbers, and bring on our effervescent and ever-popular segment host, Karen Gern. Karen, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Heather. Pleasure to be here, as usual.
So I'm so excited because we are both broadcasting live from the Logma Hall this week. And I know you haven't gotten the tour yet, but what do you think so far?
So far, it is absolutely fabulous.
Oh, great. Well, we're going to have some great fun after the show this weekend. But first, let's talk about some numbers this week, shall we?
We shall. This week, stocks finished higher on Friday in a rally built on better-than-expected quarterly results from a number of key companies, including Ford Motor, and a relief that the government doesn't plan to shutter major financial institutions. The rally pulled the Dow Jones Industrials and the Standard & Poor's 500 Index nearly to break even on the week, breaking a weekly winning streak at 6 weeks. The NASDAQ Stock Index, however, extended its streak to 7 weeks. The Dow closed up 119 points, or 1.5%, to 8,076, led by American Express, up 20.7% to $25.30, and Microsoft up 10.5% to $20.91. The S&P 500 added 14 points, or 1.7%, to 866. The NASDAQ was up 42 points, or over 2.5%, to 1694. The NASDAQ 100 Index, which tracks the largest NASDAQ stocks, was up 29 points, or 2.2%, to 1373. The Dow was up 154 points at 3:45 Eastern Time, when the index abruptly dropped about 80 points before recovering. The Dow was down 0.7% for the week, with the S&P 500 off 0.4%, and the NASDAQ was up 1.3%. The near wins for the Dow and S&P 500 were something victorious for many bulls, especially after Monday's big sell-off that saw the Dow fall 290 points. The blue chips gained 230 points over the next 4 days. For the year, the Dow is down 8%, with only 7 of the 30 stocks showing gains on the year. The S&P 500 is off 4.1%. The NASDAQ is up almost 7.5% on the year. Ford shares jumped 11.5% to $5, its first close at $5 or higher since September 30th. The company reported a smaller-than-expected loss for the first quarter and said it was on track to return to profitability in 2011. And that is your News by the Numbers for the week. I'm Karen Gurm.
Yay! Well, thank you so much. We always appreciate News by the Numbers because, goodness gracious, if we didn't have News by the Numbers, how would we know where we are if we couldn't track it week to week? So we're totally grateful for your comments this week. And do you have a certain someone poised and ready to go?
I do. I have Fred Wagenhals right here.
Great. So hang on to him for 1 second as I introduce him for our Nuts and Bolts segment, but get him ready to go.
All righty, here he is.
Now, our next guest is NASCAR diecast legend, Fred Wagenhals. Fred, being dubbed the godfather of NASCAR diecast, is not just the diecast mogul. I'm bringing you him this week as our featured guest for Nuts and Bolts, because not only was he able to make that company a success, but his entire life he has been an inventor. And some of the things that you use or may have today are some things that he invented. Now, he's been an inventor since, I don't know, probably when he was a kid, he started tinkering around with things. His most notable accomplishment, however, is what he has done with his company, which was Action Performance. And for those of you that are not NASCAR aficionados, he took this company in 8 years from zero to $400 million in sales. This does not happen easily, and this does not happen without a plan either. And our Dreams with Deadlines segment is all about goal setting. And I thought, who better could I have to talk about goal setting and long-term planning and perseverance than my husband? And so I am very fortunate to introduce him to you today. Yes, this is the man that told me that the honeymoon is over, get back to work, but I still love him dearly. And as a result of that, you folks also get this incredible radio show to listen to week and learn how to become financially independent yourself. So, Fred, welcome to the show.
Hi, hon. It's glad to be here.
I'm so excited that you're here today. I have been a longtime admirer of how you do business. Fortunately for me, because we office together, I get to see from day to day how you manage your professional life and how you strategically attack every project you have. And I just wanted to start from the very beginning. One of the things I would like you to do is kind of give us an overview of your ride with Action Performance, from when you started it, how you made your plan, and then how you executed that plan.
Well, I started the company in 1990, and it was with three girls and myself. We had a card table and four folding chairs and in a little office. And I remember we bought our first desk. One of my secretaries bought her first desk for $10 at an auction. So we came from a very humble beginning. And we built the company from zero to $400 million a year in sales. And it was done with a lot of good people. I mean, you know, everybody would like to say that they invented something and took the credit for it and built the company themselves. It's really hard to do. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I surrounded myself with good people. I was very fortunate that when I went public, I gave stock options to several people in the company, and 21 people became millionaires out of my company. So it wasn't all about me. It was about a team, building a team, focusing on goals and meeting those goals. Are you there? Heather, are you there? What? Keep talking? Hello? Well, anyway, I guess Heather wants me to keep talking. You know, she asked me several times of how do I stay motivated? on long-term goals and projects. You know, I continue to, I always say I have a case of the wants. I keep wanting something different, or bigger car, bigger home, newer, better vacations to go on. So I set goals, and I continue to try to make those goals. And when I do make them, I reward myself and do it. Because if you set a goal and don't reward yourself, you know, it's a worthless goal. So you have to continue to reward yourself if you make your goal.
So can you think of the first time you started setting goals?
Yes. I was in grade school, and there was a show that just came on TV back in the very early 50s, and it was a show called The Millionaire. And I used to watch that show every week on TV. And what I used to do, we lived on what we'd call the wrong side of the tracks. And my dad, every Saturday, I'd get up and take my bicycle, and I'd ride up the hill, and I'd go into the good side of town, and I would look at all the big homes and cars. And I used to caddy at the golf country club, and I'd see all the rich people. And I used to think, that's what I want to be someday. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I knew that's what I wanted. And my dad and mom used to say, why are you torturing yourself? And why do you go out there and look at these homes and cars and go to the clothing stores that we can't afford to go to? And that is what motivated me. And that's the things that I saw that I wanted. And I used to say my dad used to say I had a case of the wants. And, you know, I always just tried to do better for myself, my family.
There's a story that I've heard you tell a few times, and it's a funny story the way you tell it, but it wasn't a funny thing that happened to you. And what I'd like for you to do is to tell this story about when you were working on the jet boat and you launched it and it sank, and what did that do to you? Did it discourage you? Did it make you dig in more? How did you overcome that failure at that moment to still be able to persevere and not lose sight of becoming a millionaire? Tell the story and then tell us what you thought, like when it happened and what you did right after it happened to stay on track with your goals.
Well, I had developed back in the late 60s a jet pump boat that today is the Sea-Doo or the jet boats that are out there. And at that time, it was in its infant stages, and I wanted to try to sell JCPenney's, and I took a prototype I had to East Lyme, Connecticut, where their test facility was. And they were all excited about it. One of their executives got in the boat, and he had a suit and tie on, and he took off across the lake, and, you know, I'm standing on the shore, and I'm watching him go, and the motor and the pump, the hull was too light. I kept making it lighter and lighter so that it would plane and get up on plane real fast. And the motor and the had sawed its way from vibration right through the bottom of the boat. And, of course, the boat sank, and, you know, he had to swim ashore. You know, the boat sank, so I didn't have anything to take home, but I got my car, drove all the way back to Ohio, and I started over again, and you know, the product was right for the time. It was a great product, but I ran out of money, ran out of time, and I had to sell the patent and the rights to Bombardier, and you know, the rest is history. You know, today you see it's probably a billion-dollar industry, and I sold the patents for $75,000. So, you know, it's all these ideas, and I've got some I'm working on right now. I mean, I've spent the last 3 years after I sold Action working on several items, and I haven't made a penny off of any of them yet. But, you know, it boils down to, are they good products? Yes, they are. Is the timing right? Probably no. We're in a bad economy right now. Some of these products are not right for the time. I've got a couple that are, and I'm probably going to do very well with those. But, you know, I guess you never should give up on your dreams. And you know, as I look at, I keep track, and I've got a whole wall full of everything I've ever designed. And when I look at those items, I think to myself, hey, that was a great product. I had to sell it. I shouldn't have sold it. I could have made a lot of money. But that product got me to the next product, which got me to the next idea. So sometimes you might lose on an item, but it gets you to the next item, or it gets you to meet some people that can help you in your future business. So, you know, it's been a great ride. I've had, you know, a lot of businessmen only want to talk about the winners. In my book, I'm going to talk about the losers, because you can't just have all winners. Nobody just, whether you're a recording star or what, you just don't start out with hit records or hit movies or hit products. There's got to be some failures along the way to make you stronger, make you better, and make you work harder.
So in that moment when the boat sank and you just got back in the car and drove back, you know, what were you thinking? What was going through your mind? Were you just completely discouraged? How did you come to the fact that, well, I guess I'll just start over. I mean, you were embarrassed, you know, you brought these executives out just to wow them, and you wowed them in a negative way. And so how did you, with all of that negativity, continue to go forward? What was it inside of you that allowed you to go back home and get back to work?
Well, I knew what was wrong when it happened. So, I mean, I knew there was a fix to it. But, you know, I guess anybody that's ever been in business with me or done business with me, I'm not a quitter. I don't give up easily. You know, there's a certain time when I've looked at projects and said, you know, it's time to give up. But on that project, I didn't give up on the project and kept working on it. I had to give up because of the economy and the timing at that time, and I couldn't raise money to get it in production. So, you know, there's...
And at that time, you had a fledgling family that you were taking care of too, right?
Yes. And, you know,
Your kids were small at that time?
Yes. My son was probably 6 years old at that time.
So knowing that that was your primary goal, to serve your family as well, you had to kind of let go of that. But you said a minute ago how even the things that didn't work brought you to the next thing that did. So how did that moment when you had to sell it, what were you thinking? Did you already know what the next thing was? Or were you just going in search of it? How did that take you to the next item?
Well, it took me to the next item because I kind of had in mind what I would do next. And, you know, that's when I entered the snowmobile business and the all-terrain vehicle business. So, you know, I had always had some other ideas. I mean, it's just like today. I mean, you know, I'm probably working on two or three different things, and hopefully one of these come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. When I think about your life professionally and the things that you've accomplished and the road and the path you took together, I think about how almost every key in the Keys to Riches applies to you. And, you know, I think that your statement that you made about how even though this particular thing didn't work out and you had to sell out before it became a success, but it took you to the next thing, makes me think about the key review, revise, and recommit. And your goal from a child was to become a millionaire, and you realized that that particular avenue wasn't going to get you there, so you just kind of changed up your process, right? Just kind of changed up your process, but your focus was always, I'm going to be a millionaire, I'm going to be financially independent. Is that a fair assessment?
Very correct.
Go ahead.
I just, you know, never have worked for anybody ever since I got out of high school. I've just never, in my mind, I've really never had a job. I've always done what I was interested in doing, and, you know, I never felt like I'm getting up and going to work. I've always felt like, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I'm going to be and the more money I'm going to make, and that always didn't pan out that way, but, you know, hard work brings luck, and, you know, you need some timing. You need timing in life is the product the right, are you at the right place at the right time with the right product?
Now I want to talk specifically about dreams with deadlines, and that is the key for this week. And this is all about goal setting, and I wanted, because I know what you do, I know about the secret yellow pad, and so I was wondering if you could tell people how you set your annual goals and how those meet your long-term goals.
Well, you know, every year at Christmas I sit down and I look at last year's goal and I write them out on a yellow pad, and it's usually 12 to 15 goals, and it goes all the way from business goals to personal life goals to family goals. And I write, did I accomplish that, or did I halfway accomplish it, or did I fail in it? And I have these going all the way back to the 70s. And I have a notebook full of them. And, you know, I just set goals, and I look at those goals probably on a monthly basis, and I work hard to try to accomplish them. And, you know, I'm disappointed, as you all know. You've been around me at Christmas time. I get disappointed if I haven't accomplished the goal. And I try to figure out why I haven't, and sometimes I rewrite them for next year's goal. And sometimes I look at these goals and say, what the hell did I do here? I mean, why would I think I could even accomplish this? But, you know, I think I'm a big goal setter. I focus on my goals. I work hard at them. So, you know, I think that's important if you're going to make it in life.
So how are you doing on your I'm happy in my marriage goal?
Oh, not bad. No.
Not bad? Yesterday was our 11-month anniversary.
No, that's been real good. And, you know, I got a great wife, and I got a great family. I've got three wonderful children and five great-grandchildren. And, you know, I'm just excited to see what they do in their life. Two of my children are older, 45 and 40, but the grandkids and my 12-year-old son, I'm anxious to see if you know, what profession they choose and how aggressive they are in that profession. And my wife, Heather, plays a big, important part in that, and she's very supportive, and she's got her own goals, and I'm happy for her. I mean, happy to see if she accomplishes her own goals.
So if one of your grandkids was to come up to you today and say, Grandpa, how do I set goals and achieve goals? What would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them to write their goals down and work hard to achieve them and not be afraid of disappointment, but to understand that if you don't achieve your goal, you should be somewhat either upset with yourself or the things that happened that along the way that made that goal impossible for you, and understand why it became impossible. And if it is your fault, take responsibility and not blame other people, and work hard to achieve your goal.
Now, applying those principles, I want to go back to talking about action for a bit. For those people that aren't really familiar with the company itself, most everybody is familiar with the incredible products that you sold. There's, you know, people that have walls of die-cast that they've collected of their favorite driver or of every driver, and they've got their favorite ball cap and T-shirt that you made. But so many people are not really familiar with the ride you took in business. And what I would like for you to talk about, if you would, was what happened when you were a public company with regard to people shorting your stock. And I know you've referred to it as every day you got beat up, but every day you still went into the office. And how were you able to get up every day knowing that the world in the financial markets was betting on you losing? Tell us how you were able to still stay focused, how you didn't let that negativity day to day for years on end get to you.
Well, the first part of the story is when I started Action, I was a little $5-6 million company. And I knew if I could get Dale Earnhardt's license exclusively. He was the Michael Jordan of motorsports at that time. The rest would follow. And I went and got Earnhardt's license, and Dale called me from a hunting blind, and he was hunting with a good friend of his, and he called me and he said, how much would you give me for your license, my license? And I said, $300,000, guarantee, a year. Well, I didn't have the $300,000. He said, I'll take it, but I want it all up front. Well, I sold my house at that time, moved into an apartment, and gave Dale my last $300,000. Well, we took the company from $5 million that year to $17 million to $26 million to $75 million in 3 years because of his
life. Wasn't that scary, selling your house like that?
Yeah, but, you know, I really believed in what I was doing, but to be real honest with you, I thought I could build a nice 25, maybe $50 million company. You know, I blew by every expectation I ever had. And there again, it goes back to timing. The timing was NASCAR was just going crazy and shooting straight up and with their TV package. So I was at the right place at the right time with the right idea. And when I was public, we had the biggest short interest percentage-wise of any company in the United States, and the shorts were pounding me all the time. And the good part about that, the bad part was I probably spent 50% of my time focusing on Wall Street, not being creative, which was a shame because I got to grow the company better and bigger. The good part was that Action never deserved to be a $52 stock. It never deserved to be a $4 stock. It was a nice $20, $25 stock. But we went from $4 to $51.95, back to $6, back to $51.95. So a lot of people made a lot of money on our stock. And we beat the hell out of the shorts a lot of times, a lot more times than they beat me. So it got to be a game, and a very tiring game. And I used to say I never had to worry about taking drugs because I was on the all-time high and the all-time low in the same day. And there was times I was driving with my stock that I owned in the company. I remember driving home being worth $100 million one day, driving home the next day being worth $60 million, you know, losing $20, $30 million in one day. It was craziness, but it was, but I'd drive home the next day and be making $20 million. So it was a fun ride. It was a great ride for a lot of people. A lot of brokers, a lot of friends, a lot of people made money on action. So, you know, would I trade any of that? No. Would I do it over again? I don't think I'd be public again or want to be public again.
Now, when you mentioned you blew past your expectations. So when you started making those big jumps, when the first big jump hit and you went and did your annual review of your goals and you went, holy cow, I exceeded my expectations by so much, what did you do next? Did you set a conservative goal at that point, or did you try to even raise the bar more?
Well, I probably raised the bar maybe a little bit. I always set it a little bit higher than what our analyst or our expectations were from our chief financial officer.
And you did that for what reason?
To push myself and to push the people around me.
Now, that's another thing that I'd like to talk about are the people around you. Next week's key is knowledge is power, not knowing is powerful. And one of your recurrent phrases that I've heard you say over and over, and I think is a big asset to your success, like other men like you, like Henry Ford and Rockefeller, and you always say, I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And so can you talk a little bit about knowing what your personal limitations are and how to play to your strengths and what you did by, like, surrounding yourself with good people? How did you do that?
Well, you know, I always just knew what my talent was and where my strengths were, and I went out and found the best people I could find. Did I make all the right decisions? No. If I had it to do over again, I mean, you know, there's certain areas that I probably could have chose some better people. And, you know, business is kind of funny. I mean, I had several friends in my business that started with me when we were doing $1 million. And when I got to $20 million, they were still great employees, but I had to bring people in to manage them and be on top of them because they were good at $20 million, but they weren't good at $40 million. And so, you know, it's a continuous growing project, and you're always looking for, you know, it's no different than a professional football team or basketball team. They're always looking for a better quarterback or a better tight end or a better guard. And if you're in business and you're not looking for that, you're probably not going to grow.
What would you say to the person that is starting out and there's this incredible pressure, and I know that I have been a victim of it time and again, where you feel like you have to do everything and you can't delegate because you're afraid it's not going to be done or done right. or it's going to cost you too much to delegate and you only have so many resources, what would you say to that person that has that mindset that, well, you know, I have to be all things to all people? What would you say to them?
Well, I don't think you can, but I also think a true entrepreneur is a man or woman, who manages, organizes, and assumes the risk. And if you, there's no absentee ownership business. You know, you're going to be working 60, 80, 90 hours a week. You're going to have to be on top of everything. Because if you're not, the business can slip away from you. So, you know, I don't think, you know, from my standpoint, and that's me. Other people have different opinions on how they should run a business, and there's a hell of a lot more people more successful than I am. So, you know, what I did worked for me. Whether it works for somebody else, I don't know. The only thing I can say from my standpoint is, as you well know, I go to sleep thinking about it. I get up thinking about it. I'm focused, and, you know, I just think that works for me.
Well, I think it's hard to argue with the level of success that you have achieved, because I would not say that there are that many people further ahead of you, baby. I think that, but I think that the things that you do every day, because I watch you and I study you from a professional standpoint, like, how can I emulate you to at least duplicate some of the success that you have had, and what is a consistent theme that's contributed to your success? And I try to adopt those principles. So I would say that you're being a bit critical of yourself by saying it's worked for you, because I believe strongly in the fact that you have done what others have before you in a success formula. But I really believe that what you've done is duplicatable, and that's the primary reason why I wanted you to be on the show as a guest.
Well, I look at what you're doing, and I see the people you've hired, and you know, you're surrounding yourself with good people and dedicated people and people that are loyal to the cause, and you know, I just can't believe you won't be successful because of that.
But, you know, well, and you know very well that, you know, I had a hiccup last year when I bet on the wrong person, and, you know, that was really, personally, really devastating for me, because I took it so personally, and it really stopped me in my tracks and made me reevaluate whether or not that my goals were even worthwhile. And it was silly because, number one, I shouldn't have taken it so personally, and it was just a hiccup, and, you know, I just needed to get the wrong people off the bus, which happened, and get the right people on the bus, and I feel like I'm on the right track now, but, you know, it knocked me for a loop for sure.
Well,
you know, so
the other thing I did, and I'm watching you do the same thing, it can't be all about you. You know, you got to build a team. And you got to share in the wealth. You can't be the only person making all the money. And that's one of the things that I was proud of at Action. There's all my key people made a lot of money. So
how many millionaires did you make with your company?
21.
That's amazing.
So,
and
so I, you know, I'm proud of that and happy for them, and I made a lot. So, you know, a deal's not a good deal unless it's good for both parties. So everybody.
Oh, I agree.
So
that's one of my mantras, is part of something is better than all or nothing.
Yep.
And what I've learned by watching you to be truly successful and effective and be able to duplicate your efforts is you really have to surround yourself by quality people, and you have to recognize what your limitations are and know that you can delegate and still be able to accomplish your goals, but increase your effectiveness because you're working on your highest and best use. Well, I know that you probably want to get out and enjoy the weather today, so I'm going to let you go, but I just want to thank you so much for being a part of the show, honey, because I totally respect and admire what you've done professionally, and I'm just so grateful that you were able to share a little bit of yourself, because I get to see you every day, and I get to enjoy watching you still to this day, even with all your success, continue to have goals and to continue to strive and fight the good fight. And I just wanted to bring that to my listeners so they too could see that you should always have goals and always be working forward. And a goal isn't just something you do until you get it and then you're done, and you just keep making more goals. So I'm so excited that you were a part of the broadcast today, baby.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully someday you get about 5 or 6 letters from your audience say, you know, I learn a lot from this show, and my goals, I set some goals, I was successful, and my future dreams happened because of what I learned on your show. So good luck to you.
Thank you, baby. Have a great day. Wow, I'm so excited. That was such a great interview, folks. We have more in store. We have the rest of the broadcast to bring you the keys to riches and dreams with deadlines. So we will have more after this. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhals.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd busy, busy long. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a busy, busy rich, idle, 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 idle man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the
Welcome back to the broadcast. You are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am your hostess, Heather Wagenhals, and we are at the key for today, which is dreams with deadlines. This key is so important. Last week, we learned to take action and start making assessment. So we're determining where we are, and this week we're going to talk about where we want to go. If you are planning to take a trip, you got to know where you want to go. And if you want to go to the beach, you have to know which beach you want to go to, and you need to know where you're starting from so you can make the appropriate plan to travel there. Now, you can get there in a variety of different ways. So let's say, for example, you are in Phoenix, Arizona, and you would like to go to the beach in San Diego. You could go a couple of different ways. You could fly there. You could drive there. You could have somebody else drive you there by taking a bus. And if you were on Star Trek, you could morph yourself there. And accomplishing our goals is not just about setting them, but determining what our path is to get there and how fast we get there. And we want to make them objective. We want to make sure that our goals are achievable by ourselves or by surrounding ourselves with people that will help us get there. And we want to make sure that that when we pursue our goals, that we know that maybe if our current method isn't working, that we could switch up the game and still get there. That's why I say that there's a variety of ways for us to get to the beach in San Diego, and it all depends on how fast you want to get there. Now, if you say, like Fred did, I want to be a millionaire, that is a fabulous goal. But without a time frame to get there, it's merely a dream. We make a goal when we set a deadline for it to occur. Now, there is an acronym called SMART Goal Planning. And we are going to apply one of Stephen Covey's concepts in achieving our goals. Because it's great that you say, let's say, for example, that being a millionaire, having $1 million is our goal. Now, if we are currently a student in college working part-time waiting tables, and we take our dream, which is to be a millionaire, and we attach a time frame to it and make it a goal, like, say, by the end of next week, we're probably setting ourselves up for failure because that is not an objective or realistic goal unless we happen to have the matching numbers to win the lottery for next Wednesday's drawing. So given that that is not really a realistic goal for it to occur in that time frame, it could be still a realistic goal if we just attach our time frame to it. And so we're going to talk about today SMART goal planning, and we're going to use one of Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which is begin with the end in mind. So what we're going to do, and this is part of our action item for the week, is we are going to start writing down everything we want. And for the SMART acronym to work, SMART simply stands for small, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timed. Small, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timed. Okay, so the S can also mean specific. So it's not just small, but it's specific. And that's how Stephen Covey comes into play. But we don't just want to say we want to be a millionaire. We want to make this goal specific by saying we want $1 million, we want $5 million, $10 million, whatever it is. And if you're saying to yourself, well, I don't know how much I want, well, simply, it's easy to figure that out because all you have to do is say, what is my current lifestyle? What am I spending a year on my current lifestyle? And if your lifestyle is pretty much where you want it to be, but you don't have any savings or financial plans for the future, this comes in handy because we just take that annual number, and usually that's probably our income or expenditures, although last year Americans spent 130% of their income, which meant that we spent more than we made. So if we were a business, we'd be running in the red. Ideally, personally, we're running in the red, but most of us don't acknowledge that because we don't think about our financial planning like businesses do. But let's say, for example, you spent $50,000 a year and you got to take a couple of trips and you ate out at restaurants and went shopping and bought what you wanted to, and that was a comfortable lifestyle for you. Well, if you would like to retire to maintain that lifestyle, you're going to need 10 times that amount in order to be able to draw off the interest and never touch the principal. So that's very easy. So if we want to create an alternative income source that generates us $50,000 a year without touching the principal amount, we need 10 times that, or we would need $500,000 in the bank. So if your current lifestyle is at $100,000 a year, or let's say you're at 50, but you would like to go out to eat twice as much, you'd like to travel twice as much, you would like to shop twice as much, or three times as much, whatever it is that you think that you want. And remember, you can always modify your goals later because we learn how to do that in the review, revise, and recommit key. But let's say we go out to eat once a week and we go shopping every couple of months, but, you know, mostly for clothes that are just kind of replacing worn-out clothes. It's not doing a special treat here and there. So let's say we'd like to triple that, and we want to go out three times as much, shop three times as much, travel three times as much. So we take our annual income of $50,000, and we multiply it by three. So we would like a lifestyle that is at the $150,000 a year level. So then we added a zero to it, and now we know that we need $1.5 million in the bank to be able to draw off $150,000 a year without touching our principal. So that's great. So that's a specific goal. Now what we need to do is plan backwards and use Stephen Covey's plan backwards theories to make small, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timed goals. So we're going to break this big goal down into a bunch of little ones. So if we're currently making $50,000 a year, so we know exactly how to calculate our savings rate, and I know these are a bunch of numbers, but I will tell you what, for listeners for today's broadcast, if you are not currently an eZine subscriber and you would like this on a piece of paper where you can print it out and do this worksheet for yourself and help create these goals, if you subscribe to the eZine today and simply send an email to eZine, which is E-Z-I-N-E, at unlockyourwealth.com, and if you put in the subject line, subscribe me, and then put smart goals in the subject line, I will send you my worksheets that you have to pay for to be a part of the financial workshops or buy the books that teach you how to do this. I will give them to you for free just for signing up for the electronic eZine. But again, the value is to know what's on the upcoming show, see who the guests are, and get that ever-popular trivia question for the week. So simply, you would just take and figure out, based on your current income, at a savings rate of 10%, and using the rule of 72, knowing that our money will double every so many years based on our current interest rate for our investment vehicles, and know that based on your current savings rate now, and that doesn't include pay raises and things that go on down the road, you can figure out what your financial timetable is to make that SMART goal realistic. And when you figure out how long out it's going to take you to make that, then you can calculate it down to how much you need to save every day to be able to make that goal for financial independence. Now, how you get there is a variety of different ways. You can invest in the stock market, or you can also invest in real estate, which is part of the foundation for the Keys to Riches, is we are setting ourselves up for the investment in real estate. And why do we pick real estate as our investment tool? Because we know that $1 invested in the stock market earns an interest rate at $1. But $1 invested in real estate controls $5 to $10 worth of income-generating possibilities. And so our interest rate would then be at $5 or $10 versus the $1. So that's why we want to go for the real estate investment and keep some of our money in the stock market and some of our money in real estate. We also want to diversify ourselves to create multiple income streams so we're not just dependent on our paycheck or on our interest rate on what we have invested in the stock market or on our real estate portfolio. We want multiple streams of income. So that's how the goal planning works. So we're going to try to figure out what our 20-year goals are. And then when we identify what our lifestyle is like, and you want to sit back and not just have put pen to paper and write things down, but you want to get emotionally engaged in these goals. You want to be able to see it, hear it, feel it, taste it, touch it, smell it, know what it's like. If you have always wanted a Porsche or a Ferrari or to have a boat, by golly, go down to the dealership, sit in one of those cars, feel the Corinthian leather caressing your body from the seat, grip that steering wheel, look out through the windshield and envision yourself driving through the swirly hills or the long stretching roads ahead, and create that emotion and imagery and attach it to these goals. Because then our goals become real to us, and then they become personal, and then they become a part of us. The next thing we're going to do after we write out our goals and then we attach all of this imagery is we are going to visit our goals regularly. As you heard from Fred himself, he pulled those goals out and looked at them regularly. And he said, am I getting closer? Am I getting further away? And if he was getting closer, he knew, great, I could do more of the same. If he was getting further away, he identified what it was. He said, take a look at why. Is it my fault or something else? And then fix it. Take responsibility and move forward. This is the formula for success. And I'm not just telling you something. You now heard testimony from somebody who has made what I would say an incredible testament to how effective goal setting is and working towards your goals. So once we do that, we want to see them. We want them to be like our affirmations that we did in our first week. We want to be able to see them. We want them to be part of our affirmation worksheet. So when we review our affirmations at night, we also want to review our goals, short, mid, and long term. Have them on a sheet right by your bed. And make that the last thing you see at night before you go to bed. Pull those out from your nightstand and read them. Because you're putting this now into your brain and you're giving yourself, the biggest supercomputer ever, the opportunity to create the pathway. And as you sleep, your mind is going to be cranking out new ways to achieve those goals and to work on the current ways that are successful, how to improve upon those so you can achieve those goals in less time than you've given yourself to accomplish them. Then when you wake up in the morning, you want to pull out those same goals and affirmations. You want to review them again. You want to see those goals firsthand so you know what you're focused on, what your day is going to be comprised of attempting to achieve. And then you want to read those affirmations and be deeply entrenched in those to give you the confidence to pursue those goals. Then, as you get out of bed, you're going to practice next week's goals, and as inspiring as Mac Newton was, take action. Make that very next step. Take that first step that you see in your head that pops out of all night working on your goals and the first thing reviewing them, and you're going to look at those and you're going to say, okay, this is my first step toward accomplishing my goals for today. And then you're going to take the next successive step and the next successive step. Now, life deals you all kinds of things all day long, good and bad, and know that whatever it is, it was something set forth by a force greater than yourself to test your will. So what's going to happen if you get thrown for a loop? What are you going to do? You're going to pull out that affirmation and goal sheet, and you're going to read it, and you're going to shake off that negativity and get refocused on those goals. The next thing that happens, the next incredibly emotionally successful event, you just closed a sale, you overcame, you know, an upset customer and made them happy. In that emotional moment, again, let's pull out our affirmations, let's reaffirm that we're on the right path, and let's look at our goal sheet and see what those goals are and know that we're going straight to them. I like reviewing my goals multiple times a day because you can easily stray from them. Stephen Covey says you need to sharpen the saw, and I say you need to review those goals as part of the review, revise, and recommit key to stay firmly entrenched so you don't have time to be distracted from those goals if you're constantly reviewing them. And know by that personal accomplishment, by changing the way you do things, the way you set goals, the way you review goals and stay focused on that, not only does that do wonders for you, but it also does wonders for your friends and family that surrounds you. So by accomplishing your goals, you also enrich the lives of others. So today, our key statement is, in order for me to achieve the things I want in life and accomplish my dreams, I must attach deadlines to them. Our key affirmation for the week will be, I am great at goal setting and achieving my goals through action. So your key action item for this week is to write out your goals. Make them specific, yet small, measurable, achievable. Make them realistic and make sure that they have a time attached to it. You have been listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Heather Wags or check into the website at unlockyourwealth.com. We'll see you next week.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.